Imagine a master ship's captain. Like, this is a sailor who can navigate a Category 5 hurricane totally blindfolded.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right. They can read the wind and the waves to find safe harbor when, absolutely every other captain would just sink straight to the bottom of the ocean.
The kind of skill that is just genuinely awe-inspiring.
Exactly. But then, on a perfectly clear sunny day, in totally calm waters, that exact same captain deliberately steers the ship straight into a very obvious, very large iceberg.
Which just completely defies all logic.
It really does. I mean, how can sheer, undisputed brilliance coexist with such, like, catastrophic blind spots?
Yeah.
Well, welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive. Today, we are taking a fascinating journey to unpack exactly that question.
And it is quite a journey.
It is. We are diving into a massive, highly detailed research report published today, August 26, 2026, by the American newspaper and American TV. And the subject is General Douglas MacArthur.
A very heavy hitter.
Yeah. We are going to separate the towering, larger-than-life myths from the factual man. Our goal here is to shortcut your path to being fully informed on one of the most capable and, frankly, one of the most hazardous commanders of the 20th century. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
Because we are looking at a man who pulled off some of the absolute greatest military maneuvers in recorded history, and yet somehow he failed spectacularly to anticipate enemy actions or, just follow basic constitutional orders.
It is a staggering contradiction, and the beauty of today's deep dive is that we are looking at research that refuses to treat MacArthur as some flawless military saint.
Right, no halo here.
No, but it also doesn't dismiss him as just a cartoon villain or an arrogant caricature. Instead, it really presents him as a complex, high-variance case study.
High variance, I like that.
Yeah, I mean, we are looking at a man who possessed genuine operational genius, but who is also, highly prone to dangerous strategic overreach. Ultimately, his career becomes the ultimate historical lesson in why civilian control over the military is an absolute necessity.
So to understand him, you have to hold both of those truths in your head at exactly the same time.
Exactly. You really do.
Well, to really get why his downfall was so massive, I feel like we first need to establish why he was practically worshipped in the first place.
That makes sense. We have to look at the battlefield.
Right, because at the time of World War II, a lot of warfare was essentially brutal attritional grinding. I mean, you have two armies slamming into each other head-on, paying for every single inch of dirt and blood.
The literal definition of a meat grinder.
Yeah. But in the Southwest Pacific area, MacArthur did something completely different. He used a leapfrogging or bypass strategy. So leapfrogging, does that mean instead of fighting them at the front door, he's basically just sneaking in through the windows further up the coast?
That captures the mechanics of it perfectly, actually. The traditional military instinct might be to look at a heavily fortified Japanese stronghold and plan a massive, costly frontal assault to capture it.
Because you think, well, the enemy is there, so we have to go there.
Right. But MacArthur, however, he really understood the strategic leverage of geography and logistics. He and his forces would use amphibious movements to completely bypass those massive garrisons.
Yeah, just skip them entirely.
Skip them entirely. They would land 50 or 100 miles up the coast where defenses were weak, quickly seize or build airfields, gain local air superiority, and essentially cut off the enemy's supply lines from behind.
Wow.
Consider Operation Cartwheel, which is detailed extensively in the research report we're looking at.
That was the operation targeting Rabaul, if I remember correctly.
It was. Rabaul is this massive, heavily defended Japanese base. Storming the beaches to take it directly would have required a horrific blood cost.
So what do they do instead?
Instead of doing that, MacArthur's forces systematically neutralized the air, sea, and land networks entirely around the island. They basically put the base in a logistical chokehold and just let it wither on the vine.
They just starve them out of the fight.
Exactly. The enemy troops there were entirely neutralized without ever having to be annihilated in direct combat. It was a masterful use of maneuver over attrition.
That kind of thinking culminates in his absolute masterpiece during the Korean War, right? In September 1950, the Incheon landing.
Oh, absolutely.
To set the stage for you listening, the North Koreans had pushed the U.S. and South Korean forces all the way down to a tiny defensive box at the absolute bottom of the peninsula called the Pusan Perimeter.
Things looked incredibly grim at that point.
Like a total meat grinder. But instead of just pouring more troops into that defensive line, MacArthur targets the enemy's center of gravity, which, in military speak, basically means pulling out the one critical Jenga block that holds the entire enemy army up.
That is a great way to put it.
In this case, he realized the Jenga block was their overextended supply lines. But looking at the geography of Inshan, it was not some easy, obvious target. It sounds like an absolute nightmare.
It was an operational nightmare on paper. I mean, you are dealing with the Yellow Sea, which possesses some of the most extreme tidal ranges on the planet.
Meaning the water literally just vanishes.
Yes. If you miss the timing window by even a fraction, your landing craft are stranded in miles of thick mudflats, leaving your troops completely exposed.
Sitting ducks.
Exactly. And add to that an incredibly narrow maritime approach called the Flying Fish Channel that could easily be mined. Plus, there were massive seawalls the troops would have to literally scale with ladders right in the middle of a dense urban environment.
With people shooting at them?
Right. And on top of all that, a heavily fortified island called Wulmido dominated the entire approach and had to be secured first. Almost everyone in Washington, the senior naval officers, the joint chiefs, they all harbored serious reservations.
I mean, I would too. But MacArthur insisted.
He insisted. He argued that the sheer physical improbability of the landing would guarantee total surprise, and he was validated. They landed at Inshan, severed the enemy's communications, and the North Korean army virtually collapsed.
It's wild. Is MacArthur essentially like a master chess player who refuses to just trade pawns in the middle of the board and instead constantly looks for a bizarre high-risk back-rank checkmate? He just seems to see the geometry of the board entirely differently than anyone else in the room.
What's fascinating here is that while your chess analogy is a highly accurate way to visualize his mindset, we have to separate the man from the myth he actively cultivated.
Okay.
His advocacy and his willingness to absorb that extreme risk were definitely indispensable for Inshan to happen. But he wasn't a lone genius moving pieces by himself in a vacuum.
He had a whole team?
A massive team. The execution of that checkmate relied on a massive, highly competent institutional system. You had incredible naval hydrography, which is the incredible precise science of mapping the ocean floor and those extreme tides down to the inch.
Wow, yeah.
You had brilliant marine planners working out the logistics of an urban amphibious assault. You had massive air superiority overhead. And critically, you had the 8th Army simultaneously breaking out from the south to crush the enemy between two massive forces.
So Inshan was an institutional triumph, just as much as it was MacArthur's personal victory.
Exactly. It took the entire machine to make it work.
So we just saw how an institutional triumph cemented his reputation. But what happens psychologically to a person when they pull off a miracle like that?
Well, success breeds confidence.
Right. And that confidence, if left unchecked, warps into a dangerous confirmation bias. This brings us to the dark side of this narrative. Because the mind that engineered Inshan is the exact same mind that made catastrophic errors.
Some of the worst errors in modern military history.
Let's look at the 1941 Philippines disaster. This happens hours after Pearl Harbor. Washington knows the Japanese are attacking. MacArthur's headquarters in Manila knows. They have roughly 9 hours of strategic warning.
9 hours is a lifetime in war.
Right. And yet somehow, his Far East Air Force is caught completely by surprise, sitting on the tarmac and destroyed on the ground at Clark Field. How does a command structure fail that spectacularly with 9 hours of notice?
It is a profound failure of command culture under immense time pressure. The historical data shows that responsibility was somewhat distributed. There was bad weather complicating flights, severe communication delays, and confusion over targeting protocols.
But the buck stops with the boss, right?
Always. The core issue was paralysis within MacArthur's headquarters. No one wanted to initiate a massive bomber strike without MacArthur's explicit blessing, and he was largely inaccessible during those crucial hours.
Just unavailable.
Basically, yeah. Instead of executing a rapid dispersal of the aircraft or a preemptive counterstrike, the staff essentially froze. And rather than cleaning house and fixing that broken command culture after such a monumental failure, MacArthur doubled down.
He kept the same people.
He surrounded himself with an intensely loyal, insulated inner circle, famously known as the Bataan Gang.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If a leader is famously brilliant and always proves the doubters wrong, like an Inshan, doesn't that naturally make their staff terrified to contradict them? It's like a tech CEO whose past success makes them totally immune to hearing bad news.
That is a perfect modern parallel.
Like, if the boss always thinks they are right, and historically usually is right, nobody wants to be the employee who walks into the office and tells him his new flagship product is going to explode.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you are hitting on the ultimate lesson in organizational leadership. The environment MacArthur created became a pristine echo chamber.
Everyone just telling him what he wants to hear.
Exactly. When a commander strongly signals the answer they expect, intelligence gathering ceases to be an objective search for truth and simply becomes an exercise in confirming the boss's intent.
That sounds incredibly dangerous.
Oh, it is. We see the most disastrous consequence of this dynamic during the intelligence failure in Korea in late 1950. After the success of Incheon, MacArthur's forces push rapidly north, heading straight for the Yalu River, which forms the border with China.
And the Chinese were not happy about that.
Not at all. Chinese leaders were repeatedly warning through diplomatic channels that they would not tolerate hostile American-led forces approaching their border. There were massive troop movements. UN forces even had actual skirmishes with captured Chinese soldiers in late October.
But MacArthur just refuses to buy it. There was this infamous meeting at Wake Island in October 1950 where MacArthur sits down with President Truman.
The Wake Island meeting is legendary.
He basically assures the President of the United States that Chinese intervention is highly unlikely. And he adds that even if they do cross the border, U.S. air power will slaughter them. The hubris is staggering.
It really is.
But how does his intelligence chief let him walk into a meeting with the president so completely blind to the reality on the ground? Did they just throw the field reports in the trash?
Major General Charles A. Willoughby, his intelligence chief, operated precisely as that echo chamber dictated. He didn't necessarily throw reports in the trash, but he systematically filtered and altered the intelligence.
What do you mean, altered?
Well, when field commanders reported capturing Chinese regulars, Willoughby's office would downgrade those reports, labeling them as mere volunteers rather than an organized national army.
Wow. Just changing the data to fit the narrative.
Exactly. Ambiguous evidence was always interpreted in the least dangerous direction. Willoughby consistently produced estimates that minimized the Chinese threat, completely discounting the warnings, because he knew MacArthur expected a swift, final victory by Christmas.
And that filtering leads directly to a total disaster. The Chinese launch a massive counteroffensive in late November. They catch the UN forces completely off guard, shattering the front lines and forcing this horrific freezing retreat back down the peninsula.
A completely avoidable tragedy if they had just looked at the facts.
For anyone listening who relies on a team for data, whether in business or otherwise, is a stark warning. If you reward loyalty over accuracy, you are building your own trap.
The trap springs entirely from the leader's psychology. Now take that exact psychology. A man who refuses to hear bad news and surrounds himself with yes men and remove the boss entirely.
Wait, what happens then?
Let's pivot to what happens when you give a man with those traits absolute authority over a defeated nation. We move to his role as Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers, or SCP, during the occupation of Japan.
Oh, the occupation is such a fascinating era. There's this iconic photograph from September 1945 that the research report spent some time analyzing. It's MacArthur standing next to Emperor Hirohito.
A very, very famous image.
The visual contrast is deliberate and striking. MacArthur's towering over him, dressed casually, no tie, collar open, hands on his hips. Hirohito's much shorter, dressed in absolute formal morning attire. For the Japanese public, this visually inverted the imperial hierarchy practically overnight.
That photograph is a masterclass in symbolic politics. In traditional Japanese society, the emperor had been surrounded by ritual distance. He was viewed almost as a divine figure separate from the mortal realm.
So seeing him like that must have been a shock.
A massive shock. Showing the American commander casually towering over him shattered that aura of invincibility. It established who was actually in charge. But at the same time, the photograph signaled something equally important. That the emperor was safe.
Okay.
He was standing next to the supreme commander, not being publicly humiliated in chains.
And MacArthur backed up that physical protection with legal protection. The deep dive cites a January 25, 1946 cable, where MacArthur tells Washington there is no tangible evidence to prosecute Hirohito for war crimes.
Which was a very controversial stance.
Extremely. But he warns that trying the emperor would cause massive instability, widespread guerrilla warfare, and require a vastly larger occupying army just to maintain peace. He doesn't just stop at protecting the emperor, though.
No, he goes much further.
MacArthur's office literally drafts Japan's new constitution. They specifically write in Article 9, which forces Japan to renounce war entirely. It's almost like a hostile corporate takeover. Where the new CEO deliberately keeps the old, beloved founder around as a mascot to keep the employees from striking. But did he single-handedly rebuild Japan? Your hostile takeover analogy works perfectly for the mechanics of it, but the research explicitly debunks the single-handed myth. MacArthur's authority was incredibly real, and his political instincts in protecting the emperor were arguably vital to preventing a massive insurgency.
Okay, so he did play a massive role.
He did, but the reforms themselves were highly negotiated. It wasn't just a decree from a lone dictator on a mountaintop. It involved complex directives originating from Washington, brilliant foundational work by his specialized staff in the government section, and crucial participation from Japanese officials.
Like legal scholars and politicians.
Exactly. People who actually had to translate and implement these democratic changes into their own legal framework. It was a massive collaborative bureaucracy. Furthermore, we have to look at the reverse course.
The reverse course, that's the shift in priorities as the geopolitical weather change, right?
Precisely. Initially, the goal was maximal democratization, breaking up corporate monopolies, encouraging labor unions, and liberalizing education. But as the Cold War ramped up, Washington started worrying intensely about Soviet and Chinese communism spreading in Asia.
So they changed their minds on how to run Japan.
Completely. The occupation shifted drastically toward economic stabilization and anti-communism. Labor strikes that were previously encouraged were suddenly clamped down on by MacArthur's forces.
So MacArthur was a vital symbol and a powerful executive. But the occupation was really a complex, evolving system driven by global pressures, not just one man's creation.
That is exactly right.
Which sets the stage for the final explosive chapter. He acted like a sovereign king in Japan, operating a massive bureaucracy with very little pushback. But back in Korea, the reality of a limited war comes crashing down.
It hits him like a freight train.
He wasn't a sovereign. He had a boss.
Yeah.
He had to answer the President of the United States. This is where his unyielding, categorical worldview fatally collides with the U.S. Constitution and the terrifying stakes of the Cold War.
It is the ultimate breaking point. After that massive Chinese counteroffensive shattered the UN lines, the Truman administration, along with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, completely changed their strategic priorities.
Because they realized they couldn't just win easily anymore.
Right. They realized that trying to conquer all of North Korea was far too dangerous. They prioritized a limited war. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Omar Bradley, famously testified that expanding the war into China would be the wrong war, at the wrong place, at the wrong time, and with the wrong enemy.
That's a pretty definitive statement.
Very. Their primary concern was Europe. They were terrified of triggering World War III with the Soviet Union, who, remember, now possessed atomic weapons.
But MacArthur vehemently disagrees with this shift. He believed that political restrictions, like telling him he couldn't bomb enemy supply bases just across the border in Manchuria, or that he couldn't use Taiwanese forces to open a second front, were creating artificial sanctuaries for the enemy.
Which frustrated him to no end.
He felt he was being told to fight a war while Washington protected the very people killing his soldiers. Now, this is where we have to bust a massive historical myth.
Yes, let's do that.
A lot of people think MacArthur was fired because he went rogue and tried to push a button to drop nuclear weapons on China without permission.
That is a very common misconception. The deep dive is clear that atomic contingencies were actually being discussed by many policymakers in Washington at the time. It wasn't just MacArthur bringing it up as some rogue operator.
Wait, really? So why was he fired?
He was not fired for proposing extreme military options in private planning sessions. He was fired for publicly contesting national policy after receiving direct orders to clear all of his statements through Washington.
Oh, wow. So he was basically insubordinate in public.
Yes. He issues these uncoordinated public statements, basically taunting the enemy commander, which totally derails Washington's delicate diplomatic efforts to negotiate a ceasefire.
Just stomping all over the president's diplomacy.
Exactly. The final nail in the coffin is the March 20 letter he writes to Representative Joseph Martin, the Republican leader in the House. MacArthur basically argues against the president's policy, defamously claiming that in war, there is no substitute for victory.
And Martin just keeps that private.
Nope. Representative Martin reads this letter aloud on the floor of Congress. So on April 11, 1951, Truman officially relieves MacArthur of his command.
Now wait, we have to talk about the Senate hearings that followed because they are crucial to understanding how the public absorbed this. MacArthur comes home to ticker tape parades. The public is furious at Truman, but then the Senate holds what become known as the MacArthur hearings. How did those hearings change the narrative?
The Senate hearings were the moment the curtain was finally pulled back for the American public. MacArthur testified, leaning heavily into his belief that military victory must be pursued at all costs. But then the Joint Chiefs of Staff testified.
And what did they say?
They laid out, in terrifying detail, the horrific risks of MacArthur's desired escalation. They explained that bombing China would likely trigger a mutual defense pact with the Soviet Union.
Meaning World War III.
Exactly. It proved to the public that escalating the war in Asia would strip critical defenses from Europe and likely trigger a global nuclear war. The hearings essentially dismantled MacArthur's argument by exposing the sheer scale of the gamble he was willing to take.
And what was happening in Korea while this was going on?
Meanwhile, over in Korea, General Matthew Ridgway takes over the 8th Army from MacArthur. Ridgway completely turns the morale around, proving that the front line could be stabilized and pushed back without expanding the war to China.
So what does this all mean? I'm going to push back on behalf of anyone listening who might be putting themselves in MacArthur's boots. But wait, from a purely military standpoint, wasn't MacArthur right? If you're fighting a war, shouldn't you try to definitively win it rather than fighting with one hand tied behind your back?
This raises an important question about how grand strategy actually works in a democracy. From a purely tactical level, MacArthur's frustration is entirely understandable. Being bombed from a base you were not allowed to attack is a tactical nightmare.
Right. It feels totally unfair.
It does. But classical grand strategy dictates that military aims must always be subordinate to political purpose. The military does not fight just for the sake of winning a battlefield victory. It fights to achieve a specific political end state for the nation.
Meaning, the goal wasn't to destroy China or conquer Asia. The goal was to keep the global alliance intact and prevent a nuclear World War III.
Precisely that. Washington decided that achieving a total unconditional victory in the Korean Peninsula was simply not worth the massive risk of sparking a global nuclear conflict with the Soviet Union.
The juice wasn't worth the squeeze.
Exactly. And here is the crucial constitutional point. The U.S. Constitution assigns the authority to make that incredible risk trade-off decision to elected civilian leaders. It does not belong to a theater commander, no matter how brilliant his maneuver strategies are.
So MacArthur just couldn't accept that he wasn't the top boss.
MacArthur treated military victory as a categorical imperative that overrode everything else. By publicly fighting the president's policy, he wasn't just offering a different tactical strategy. He was challenging the fundamental premise of civilian control over the military.
That distinction really cuts to the core of this deep dive. We've spent our time unpacking a truly high-variance commander. MacArthur's story proves that unchecked operational genius eventually becomes a strategic liability.
It really does.
The exact traits required to pull off an impossible miracle at Incheon supreme arrogance, an ironclad belief in your own vision, and a refusal to listen to critics are the exact same traits that will completely blind you at the Yalu River when the enemy is massing at your borders. You can't have the miracle without the monster, which is exactly why institutional guardrails and civilian control exist in the first place.
As we close, there's one final fascinating thought from the research regarding historical memory that I think is worth reflecting on. Think about how differently this one single man is remembered based entirely on where you happen to stand on the map today.
Oh, that's a great point.
In the United States, he holds a deeply dual legacy. A decorated hero of multiple wars, but also the ultimate constitutional cautionary tale. But travel to South Korea, and he's remembered primarily as a savior and a liberator.
Walk along the coast in Incheon, and you will see massive statues of him looking out over the water.
Consider the Philippines. He is deeply revered as the man who kept his famous promise, "I shall return." But historians there also grapple with the dark reality that his liberation campaigns brought absolute catastrophic destruction to the city of Manila.
Such a complex legacy.
And finally, if you examine historical memory in China, he is viewed through an entirely different lens as the ultimate symbol of Western imperial aggression who threaten their national borders.
It's incredible. It brings us right back to our opening hook. That master captain who navigates the hurricane perfectly but steers straight into the iceberg. It begs a really fascinating question for you to explore on your own. What does it mean for history and for our fundamental understanding of truth if the absolute defining legacy of a person's life changes entirely depending on which national border you are standing inside? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Check your assumptions, break out of your echo chambers, and we will see you next time.